We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both formerly with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Lots to cover, starting with, actually, very surprising eviction and arrest that happened yesterday at West Seattle Family, the Bartons.
Yeah, the funny how these things always happen on Friday. The King County Sheriff's Office, after repeated assurances that they would not arrest a disabled veteran and his family who had been fighting foreclosure and an auction of their home in West Seattle, Byron and Jean Barton. They were arrested yesterday for living in their home by King County Sheriff's deputies, both they and their adult son. And Byron Barton, who is in a wheelchair as a result of his injuries, literally spent the day being hauled around from one facility to another, with various people refusing to take him because of his medical needs. It really sounds rather nightmarish. The justification for this given by Sheriff John Urquhart, talking about, well, in the past, what we've talked about is the, refusing to enforce the, reinforce the request of the bank. But in this case, it was Triangle Property Development, which is the company that bought the property, in the, auction that the, Bartons are challenging in court, that had asked for a summary judgment and for the sheriff's deputies to come in. And so they did and came in and arrested them on trespass charges. And the Triangle now occupies the home. Rather surprising because, as I mentioned, the Bartons are challenging the legality of both the foreclosure proceedings originally by Chase Bank and the actual auction in court. And the sheriff's office and Urquhart had said previously, as has Seattle Mayor Ed Murray, regarding SPD enforcement of this, that they would wait until the legal process played itself out. That somehow magically changed, and so now the Bartons are arrested, and the property is no longer in their hands. And
the property sits empty, right? Triangle can't occupy. I mean, it's a company. It can't occupy a foreclosed home. It can only padlock it.
Well, yes, except that they've apparently actually got people in there, at least during the day yesterday. I don't know that that's the case overnight. I doubt it.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, Triangle has the property now. And there's when we get to events at the end of the program, we'll mention one on Monday for people trying to protest that outcome.
All right. Moving on, some changes at SDOT.
Yeah, the Seattle Department of Transportation. It came to light this week that SDOT hadn't completed the implementation plan for the city's bicycle master plan, which was supposed to be finalized and completed last month. In fact, they haven't even started the implementation plan. Now, the city's Bicycle Advisory Board, which is supposed to oversee the implementation of the Bicycle Master Plan, had sent several requests for a status update to the Seattle Department of Transportation, and they had received no answer at all, no official answer at all from the department as to the status of the implementation plan. Murray's new director of SDOT, Scott Kubley, was just appointed, so of course we can't turn to him and say, dude, what happened?
Yeah, and their interim director resigned this week.
Well, yeah, the former Mayor Mike McGinn's original director of SDOT, Peter Hahn, was fired by Murray shortly after Murray took office. And then in the interim, SDOT was run by McGinn's deputy director, Goran Sparman, who, as Jav said, resigned this week after not being chosen for the job as top director. He'd been angling for that for a while. So my question is, did Sparman's resignation have anything to do with the delayed implementation plan at all, or was it just because he was angling for the top job, and because he'd been working so hard for that, the implementation of the bicycle master plan just didn't get done in the interim?
And something of an irony that the Ginn's transportation guy in an administration that was all about bicycles and bicycle plans, that in the end couldn't be bothered with it because he was more interested in perhaps in getting a job.
Yeah, and I should point out too that this does matter, because without an implementation plan, the city starts making decisions. in terms of where to, what projects to fund without anything to really guide them about what should be a priority. So you get chaos. Things get funded that may be really cool projects, but are they really going to move us forward on our goals under the Bicycle Master Plan?
And departments are right now in the next couple of months making decisions for the 2015 budget on which programs and which projects to fund in this coming year.
Which is why the implementation plan should have been done in the middle of last month.
Yeah, it's not going to get done in time at this point, clearly.
All right. Moving on, some new developments with the lawsuit against $15 an hour.
Yeah, two very powerful national business lobbying groups joined the federal lawsuit against Seattle's $15 an hour minimum wage, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the National Restaurant Association. Now, the suit was brought by the International Franchise Association, which says that franchisees should be treated as small businesses under the $15 an hour minimum wage law and allowed 5 to 7 years to reach that $15 wage. Wage level instead of 3 to 4 years like other large businesses. Now, other groups that have joined the suit include the American Hotel and Lodging Association and the Washington Retail Association. When the U.S. Chamber of Commerce joins in and the National Restaurant Association, that just ups the amount of money that can be poured into the lawsuit. And that's a bad sign for local government's ability to set the minimum wage.
Let me put this in a little bit of context. This is a much, much larger issue than Seattle's local minimum wage law. What the International Franchise Association, the various organizations that have signed on to this lawsuit, and the lead attorney on this, mind you, is the former Bush Solicitor General from the Bush administration, who is a very high-powered conservative attorney. He, in fact, was the lead attorney in the Supreme Court case challenging Obamacare. This is the conservative movement's attempt to not only challenge the minimum wage laws, but to challenge the government's entire ability to regulate businesses. That's what they're going for with this, and they're trying to get it, far enough to get it to a conservative Supreme Court, recognizing that they're likely to lose in lower courts because what they're doing is challenging really 100 years of settled law by challenging the city's ability to regulate wages. It's a very, very large stakes with a lawsuit that on the face of it,
I would say if you're talking about regulate business at all, we're talking about more than 100 years of law.
Sure. But the idea here is that this is likely to be laughed out of the lower courts, but if they can find particularly in the rather liberal Ninth Circuit, but if they can get it to, and there's a parallel lawsuit in, I believe, Atlanta that will face more conservative lower courts, if they can get enough contradictory rulings among the different districts to get it to the conservative Supreme Court, even though you're looking at upending that much precedent, they feel like they actually have a chance to do this, and Seattle is going to help them do it.
And it looks like they're starting to collect what could be unlimited funds.
Yeah, and this is why you're seeing these major, major national groups signing on to this lawsuit for what is a relatively minor in the large scheme of things issue with Seattle's minimum wage.
All right. Moving on, preschool initiatives going to the ballot?
Yeah, there were two preschool initiatives on the November ballot. The way that the King County Elections Department wrote the ballot was to pit those two initiatives against each other. The backers of one initiative, I-107, which would raise preschool teachers' pay to $15 an hour in 2015, and set new training requirements. Those backers, who are primarily labor unions, they decided to take that to court and to challenge that and say, well, why can't voters be allowed to vote on both initiatives instead of choose between one or the other? King County Superior Court Judge Helen Halpert ruled this week that the two initiatives can certainly be pitted against each other on the ballot. Voters will have to select one or the other or vote no on both, but they cannot vote yes on both. The other initiative is Mayor Murray's and the City Council's preschool plan to raise property taxes to subsidize preschool for low-income kids. Now, Halpert deemed that both initiatives dealt with the same subject and that state law therefore requires them to be pitted against each other on the ballot, although you could definitely argue that what you pay preschool teachers is a different subject from providing funds to subsidize preschool for low-income kids. So, and of course, the backers of I-107 have said that they're going to appeal that decision.
Okay. Also this week, State Supreme Court is going to entertain charter schools.
Yeah, the State Supreme Court announced yesterday that it will hear a case on the constitutionality of charter schools in Washington State. Back in December, King County Superior Court Judge Gene Reichel ruled that parts of the state's charter school law are unconstitutional, particularly the use of taxpayer money for funding charter schools. Now, voters passed the charter school initiative back in 2012 after many, many tries over many years. Charter school proponents finally got an initiative passed. Now, the suit was brought by the Washington Education Association, the League of Women Voters, El Centro de la Raza, several parents and students in the Seattle School District, and other school advocates, all attempting to halt what they see as the privatization of the state's school system and the funneling of taxpayer money into those private schools. Now, state Supreme Court said that it will allow this lawsuit to bypass the appeals process, which is unusual, and that it will take up the case and hear it, which I think is a sign that the state Supreme Court really realizes this is an important issue.
And it's very interesting also that you have, one of the main proponents of charter schools, certainly in urban areas like Seattle, point to, urban and non-white communities as being the primary beneficiaries of charter schools, that poor schools and inner cities, that this is an alternative that provides better education. Well, aside from the fact that the test scores indicate that they don't provide better education, it's interesting to see El Centro de Barraza and some other anti-poverty groups specifically joining this lawsuit on the understanding that for the vast majority of students in lower income districts, charter schools simply drain money and funding from the schools that are already, as we've seen with McCleary, badly underfunded.
Yeah, opponents of charter schools have long pointed out that the reason why charter schools have similar results to the public school system is because charter schools can expel or remove students who do not perform well. And that therefore charter schools, by not serving the entire population of a district or a city or a region, that the charter schools are really not performing as well as the public schools, who can only expel students for disciplinary problems, not because they're not performing up to standards in their classes.
Yeah, and the flip side of that, of course, is they tend to draw parents who are more involved in their kids' education and the higher performing students as well.
All right. And finally, locally, Mayor Ed Murray came out with a statement yesterday.
Yeah,
a couple days ago,
Ed Murray came out with a statement on the shootings and subsequent protests in Ferguson, Missouri, which we'll talk about in a minute. And Murray's statement was fairly perfunctory, expressing condolences to the family of Michael Brown and saying, we would never do that here and so forth. All the things you would expect a mayor to say. What was really interesting was the Seattle Police Department's response to Murray's statement. SPD Sean Whitcomb in response to a media question, saying that the SPD, unlike the folks in Missouri, don't use militarized equipment. And this is a direct quote. As far as this notion that we might use, we meaning SPD, might use militarized equipment, I'm happy to say that we don't. We are police service. The police Seattle Police Department uses equipment and gear that is specific to our profession, and our profession delivers public safety services. Now, if weasels have a language, this is what it sounds like. It turns out SPD doesn't categorize SWAT toys, that is equipment used by SWAT teams, as militarized. SPD's own blog has a long list of gear that they've gotten as military surplus from just one of the Department of Homeland Security programs that has for years post 9/11 been giving surplus or used military equipment to local police departments. That blog entry is not complete by any stretch of the imagination, but it is still quite lengthy. And you hear equipment specific to our profession is meaningless, given that all kinds of departments, large and small across the country, have been getting this equipment, and so for that equipment is specific to their profession. Our profession deserves public safety services. Begs the question. It's the kind of a PR phrase that PR consultants love, but that out here in the real world gets subjected to endless ridicule on on programs like this one. It really does underscore how much of a separate world SPD is living in, and why people in the community don't trust them, because there are plenty of photos and plenty of evidence, including in SPD's own publications, that they're lying. Not to put too fine a point on it, they use plenty of militarized equipment and have for at least 15 years, at least since WTO and probably before.
All right. Moving on then to national and what has been justifiably getting a lot of media attention this week, the shooting and killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson.
Yeah, in Ferguson, Missouri, the shooting of an African-American teenager, Michael Brown, by a white police officer for the crime of walking in the middle of the street.
Now, in an apartment complex.
Yeah, and of course, the resulting protests by the African-American community in Ferguson, which was followed by a very aggressive suppression campaign by a highly militarized police force using stun grenades, tear gas, rubber bullets, wooden baton rounds, and, as Job mentioned, surplus military hardware, including military-grade rifles, army fatigues, and body armor.
Yeah, there's a great photo that was making the rounds on Twitter and Tumblr of one of the protesters, and he was shirtless because it's the middle of August in Missouri.
Uh-huh.
It's hot, and he's just standing there, shirtless and with shorts and not particularly doing anything, and you could see the rifle. The laser sighting on his chest from a sniper, and the placement of snipers around nonviolent protesters, and a lot of that kind of, you were waiting for the bullwhips and dogs, really.
Yeah, yeah. And it really brought to the nation's attention as we've been talking about, the militarization of U.S. police forces, even in relatively small communities like Ferguson, which has maybe 21,000 people. And only about 53 police officers, 50 of whom are white and 3 of whom are black for a community that is primarily African American. And it really, I looked at it and I said, this looks to me exactly like what we saw, in the initially nonviolent protests of the WTO, which were met by a very, very aggressive, highly militarized police response.
Yeah, the difference here is that
There's a couple of differences. The first difference is the race of the victim, and the protesters in Ferguson really highlighted how the Pentagon's surplus military hardware program, which provides this hardware to these police forces, has been deployed against communities of color primarily, especially since 9/11. And then, of course, the other main difference is the social media got hold of these images and really flashed them around the world. And I want to also emphasize too that when I say social media, I don't mean monolithic organization or entity. I'm talking about ordinary Americans got a hold of these photos and got a hold of this information and used their, handheld technology to really express their unease and their disgust with what's happened to police forces.
And one of the reasons that the story got so much attention, aside from the fact that it got enormous traction on social media, was the police made the elementary mistake of arresting and reporters and trying to bar media from the area as well. Mm-hmm. And going to the point of saying, you can't record any images of what you're doing here, and trying literally setting up
which
barriers.
Which is patently unconstitutional.
Yes, and literally setting up barriers at the edges of it's a suburb among many, many suburbs in St. Louis County, setting up barricades at the edge of the city and trying to keep people out. It was, while
doing exactly what was done during the WTO, which is barricading off portions of a city and then telling people they can't go home, essentially pushing them in certain directions, corralling them and telling them you can't leave from this area, things like that.
Yeah, and the geography of the metropolitan St. Louis area, very similar to that of a lot of cities back east. Of course, Seattle, we don't see this as much because it's such a much larger white population here than most large American cities. But you have a lot of white flight in St. Louis. The inner city itself is primarily African American. And then the suburbs also have diverged between the wealthier south part of the metropolitan area, which is primarily white, and then the northern suburbs tend to be primarily non-white, primarily immigrant and African American. And that's the context of Ferguson. And St. Louis County, which is a suburban county that surrounds the city, is divided in this way, so that when St. Louis County sheriff's deputies came in after the outrage over how Ferguson police were handling the situation, they were just as bad. And so it's now actually the federal government and the Department of Justice has taken the lead, and oddly enough, things quieted down almost immediately once that took place.
And it's interesting because this all happened in the space of 1 week. So what we saw in the space of just 6 or 7 days was an end to police riots in Ferguson, congressional attempts now to rein in the Pentagon's surplus weapons program, a call to demilitarize police forces around the country, and then the DOJ stepping in to Ferguson and saying that they're not only going to oversee the police force, but they're going to investigate the Michael Brown shooting. So it's just amazing to me that all happened in about the space of 6 days.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is, as Maria mentioned, legislation being drafted, I believe being spearheaded by an African American representative from Atlanta, mm-hmm. Whose name unfortunately escapes me at the moment, to draft legislation to rein in the amount of surplus military equipment going to local police forces and rein in its use as well.
Yeah,
we'll see if that does any better than
any
they
traction.
Had tried that actually back in June and mm-hmm. Was shot down, including by the bulk of the Washington State congressional people. McDermott and Adam Smith were the only people that supported it. So
yes,
we'll see if those law and order Democrats and Republicans can now get on the bandwagon to demilitarize the police forces.
Yes, and I'm not sure if shot down is a really inappropriate phrase or a very appropriate phrase.
All right. Let's move on to international and developments this week in Iraq.
Yeah, this week, Nouri Kamal al-Maliki, the former prime minister of Iraq, became the former prime minister. He was forced out, finally, kicking and screaming, after he initially said that he would possibly deploy the military and police in order to maintain power. And then when he got pressure not to do that, he said, well, I'm going to take you all to court to stay in office. And it wasn't until the pressure from the United States, Iran, and prominent Shiite religious figures, including Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, really came down hard on him, and they eventually offered him amnesty from prosecution for any acts he committed as prime minister, that he finally stepped back and said, okay, well, you can let your guy be the new prime minister.
Somebody from the same party.
The new guy who is going to be the prime minister is another Iraqi exile and member of his own Dawah party, Haider al-Abadi, which I am not at all sure will be a better choice, since, of course, when you appoint yet a third Iraqi exile to run a country where he doesn't have a real base of support, you're going to see him pandering to the Shiites over the Sunnis and the Kurds, and that's, I think, just going to exacerbate the divisions there.
Yeah, and he doesn't really have much of a country at this point. It's really more Baghdad and the areas immediately surrounding
south
Baghdad.
Baghdad.
Yes,
too.
Because he doesn't have control over the Kurdish areas, and as we've keep hearing in the news, doesn't have control over vast portions of the north and west of the country that are now in the control of the Islamic State. Maliki's statement just before he was forced out that holding on to the premiership, this is a direct quote, is an ethical and patriotic duty to defend the rights of voters. The insistence on this until the end is to protect the state. So it was, a matter of principle and saving the state and defending the voters. And And the fact that without U.S. backing and the office's life wasn't worth a plug nickel, that part was totally irrelevant. But he has in fact now been forced out. There is a new guy that has been sworn in, and it's not clear that he's going to last very long either, quite frankly, because at this point the actual state of Iraq is dissolving, and there are enormous amounts of spoils in the form of oil revenue and oil facilities that are up for grabs from a lot of different sources, not just the Islamic State, the Kurds who have wanted the autonomy for a long, long time, various factions in the southern part of Iraq. And this has all been put in motion, has been put in motion for some time by the original invasion in 2003. This is what set all of this in motion. It is not Obama's fault. It is not the fault of failure to intervene in the Syrian civil war. Once you ignore the national borders that were set by a colonialist a century ago, that unleashes forces that are hard to put back in the bottle.
All right, and Egypt.
Yeah, this week Egypt deported the top leaders of Human Rights Watch on the eve of their announcement of their report on last year's coup in Egypt. The Human Rights Watch report compares the death toll during the coup last year in Egypt to China's Tiananmen Square killings in 1989 and says that the Egyptian military's Rabaa massacre last August was actually worse than the death toll from Tiananmen Square. The report also directly blames Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who is the current president of Egypt and was the former defense minister last year during the coup, for actions that, quote, likely amounted to crimes against humanity, end quote. The report also names other top officials of the Egyptian government as folks who should probably stand trial for these crimes. I should point out, too, that over 1,000 people died in the Rabaa massacre, where the Egyptian military swept into the center of Cairo to disperse a tent encampment of Mohamed Morsi's followers who were protesting him being deposed by the military coup.
And that was done entirely with U.S. weaponry and, as it turns out, with U.S. diplomatic backing as well.
And, yes, the Egyptian military is still currently running the country with U.S. backing.
Events.
A number of them going on. Of course, HempFest is going on all this weekend. The first HempFest since the legalization of marijuana, and the smell of weed is wafting through Belltown even as we speak. People getting an early start. A lot of other things going on today too. At noon, there's a demonstration for Palestine in support of folks in Gaza, and that of course is still a very tense situation. That at noon at Westlake Center at 4th and Pine, there will be a shift change, and at 4 o'clock also in Westlake Center there will be a protest in opposition to the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson and subsequent police actions. That at 4 o'clock in Westlake. Also in Gasworks Park this afternoon at 1 o'clock, March Against Monsanto folks sponsoring Swarm Seattle to Save the Bees, drawing attention to the use of inorganic compounds and Monsanto's complicity in the devastation of the bee population around the world. That's at 1 o'clock in Gasworks Park. Monday, 1 o'clock, SAFE, the anti-eviction and foreclosure organization that has been working with the Bartons in West Seattle, as I talked about early in the program. They are going to be having a protest over the King County Sheriff's Office's handling of that situation. That will be at Courthouse Park, adjacent to the King County Courthouse, at 3rd and Yesler, between Yesler and James, off 3rd, downtown Seattle, Monday at 1 o'clock. And then Wednesday, August 20th, the Block the Boat blockade of an Israeli Zim ship in Seattle and Tacoma. There's a bunch of logistical information around that. Both Seattle and Tacoma, they're going to be trying to blockade this ship as it comes into port. So if you go to Facebook and search for Block the Boat, it will come right up, and you can get the information on that.